From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why it is you might hate the media. Our guest is Rolling Stone reporter Matt Taibbi, who's written a book that he describes as an insider's guide to the pressures at work in media. He's pretty critical, says instead of just searching out and reporting facts, we're exploiting people's desire to root for their own team and hate the rest. We'll be right back.
KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app, available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've seen those cable news shows where people are debating an issue. And a lot of the time, there's a split screen, so it's pretty clear. One person is on one side, the other is, well, on the other. And it looks authentic enough. The pundits and the experts are passionate and engaged, but Matt Taibbi says it's not real. The subjects are real enough, the stakes of war or justice or immigration policy, but the debate you're watching, he says, often it's just manufactured theater. It's choreographed. It's the media narrowly hunting demographics because they know if you feel outrage or even if you feel actual hate, you will watch. It's just one facet of the media that Taibbi critiques in a new book. He explores the motives and the pressures in this unique ecosystem. The motives, he says, aren't all that new, but the platforms, they are, and the players are too. His book is called Hate Incorporated, How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate One Another. Taibbi is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. Among his books is I Can't Breathe. It's about the killing of Eric Garner by New York City police. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. We should talk about your perspective here first, because as you point out in the book, you grew up in the media. Your dad in the glory days of local TV news. Start there, just the perspective you saw as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, as I point out in the book, I have been around journalists my entire life. When I was born, my father was actually working at the Home News in New Jersey. He started when he was 18. I was born when he was 20, and everybody I knew growing up was a reporter. Pretty early in my life, we moved to New England, and he became a television reporter, kind of in the heyday of local television news. So my childhood was basically a lot like the movie Anchorman. Right. I was surrounded by people with the bad facial hair and those ridiculous mics they had back then, and that was it growing up. So I've been around this business my whole life, and I'm very attuned to the changes that have happened in it. And this is one of the reasons that I decided to write this book.
Well, you talk about how journalism became a kind of an intimate part of your identity, and I wanted to ask a little bit more about what influence your father, seeing your father, had on you, because there's something that you write about, this kind of after work ritual of his where he'd pour a drink and then get on the phone.
Yeah, the phone attack.
Yeah.
My dad is he's very old school, and he had this ritual where he would come home from work, and this was back in the days when people had Rolodexes, and he had a million sources, and what he would do is he would just sort of pick people out at random and pour himself a drink and smoke a Camel unfiltered cigarette and just call people to find out what was going on in their lives. And the idea behind that was and he would tell me this later, is that when, you know, the whole idea behind being a reporter is that you can't just call sources when you need something. You have to just sort of constantly stay in touch and be interested in their lives and talk about what they want to talk about. And so, you know, at a crucial moment, they will call you when they have something, or when you call them, they'll be more interested in helping. And, you know, plus it's also just a cool thing.
Yeah. So you say you kind of figured you had understood journalism, and then you read the book Manufacturing Consent by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky. And this is how you put it in the book. You say it blew your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, again, I had been raised by my father, who was really into the whole ethics of journalism and, you know, being factual and the story is the boss. That was something he would say all the time. Like, you just go where the facts lead you. And so I had this idea that there was no deception or propaganda aspect to American media. I mean, I was young.
Yeah.
And then I read Manufacturing Consent, which to me was an amazing book about American politics, but also about how the media works. And he talked about things that I had been looking at, you know, directly my whole life, but had never really understood. One of them being this idea that you don't censor things, but you sort of keep the poles of permitted discussion artificially narrow. Mm-hmm. And that was something that, you know, it took me a while to really grasp, but it was an important book, and it explained how most Americans can be ignorant of things that their countries are involved in, despite the fact that the news isn't directly regulated.
It's interesting, too. One of the kind of central findings in that book was that this limiting argument that the kind of, I guess, censorship, maybe that's not quite the right word, but all of this was, in fact, unconscious. I mean, that was a really important part of what Chomsky and Herman were getting at.
Yeah, it's probably 99% unconscious, maybe at the very senior levels of the biggest media companies you might have some conscious political discussions. But for the most part, a lot of it has to do with who rises in media organizations, who gets promoted, who gets the front page and who doesn't. And one of the things that, you know, I learned in my own career and have observed with colleagues is that people who are difficult personalities, who are sticklers for, you know, telling things as they are, they tend not to rise very far in the biggest media companies. They tend to get washed out pretty early. And there are a lot of sort of cautionary tales of, you know, like people like Chris Hedges or even Seymour Hirsch. You know, they tend to have these peripatetic lifestyles where they burn out. Whereas the, you know, the people who kind of tote the party line and say, you know, the stay toward the middle of the road politically, they tend to rise pretty quickly in the media, and that those are the people who we hear the most from.
Yeah.
You know, in national media.
It's that policing mechanism that Chomsky writes about. He calls it flack, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And the interesting thing about that is that he was writing about a process that was pretty slow and mechanical back in the day. Like, for instance, you know, back in the 70s, if you had a reporter who too critically wrote about the Vietnam War or sent back the wrong kind of coverage, you might get a series of letters from an organization like the Freedom House. It's, you know, some sort of quasi-governmental think tank that would chide the news organization for being too radical, and then they would back off and give a more patriotic version of events. Now, that same process is accelerated a thousandfold because you don't have to wait for letters to come from anywhere or anyone to come. You know, mm-hmm. it comes through social media in 10 seconds. So that was one aspect of Chomsky's theory that I thought was interesting that has, you know, has gotten significantly more worse since then.
Yeah. Well, everything's changed. Everything's been accelerated, which we'll get to. But I wanted to – there's a good story that you mentioned that really illustrates Chomsky's theory, and it's the story that you mentioned of Walter Cronkite when he comes back from Vietnam. This was in 1968, and he gives this editorial that people thought was so groundbreaking and honest. Talk a little bit about the debate that came from all of this, because this is kind of what you gives us a sense of what you call the fairway of American
right.
thought.
Yeah. So Cronkite came back in 1968, and this was after the Tet Offensive, and he gave a very negative view of the war, which incidentally, behind the scenes, we now know that a lot of the senior military leaders had also come to this conclusion that that there was no way they were going to, quote-unquote, win, whatever that meant, and that the military situation was untenable, and even though we had very good intentions, we had overstayed our welcome, and people, you know, especially American soldiers, were needlessly dying. That was sort of one pole of the conversation, and that's become still to this day kind of the predominant sort of liberal take on the Vietnam War. The other extreme, which is also still being argued, is that, you know, we should have just stuck to our guns, and that if we had more support behind the war effort, mm-hmm. and people like Walter Cronkite hadn't undercut national opinion, that we might have prevailed, and our good intentions might have had more fruit in Vietnam. So you have these two poles of argument, and people are arguing in the media about it. But what you don't hear is this other take on the situation, which is the one that most people probably outside of America have, which is that we were the aggressors there, that, you know, 3 million people died in the war. You know, we had 60,000 casualties. They had millions. We had strategic hamlets that were just horrible. And, you know, the atrocities, the Agent Orange, which persisted to be and continued to be a problem for 20 or 30 years after we left.
Napalm.
Excluded. Yeah. Napalm, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, all that stuff is excluded. But you do have a debate about the war. So that's sort of the classic Chomskyan example of kind of an artificially limited argument.
Well, it seems like this idea of a fairway. I mean, you thought about calling the book Fairway for a while. Or you did call it for a while. So this is important to you, this idea that that we have these two poles of thought, but there's a ton of stuff that's being left out that we're not even talking about or hearing about.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, this is my frustration as a reporter, is that, you know, increasingly now, especially in the age of Trump, there's really only two ways of looking at things. And those parameters are very clearly defined, and the allowable opinion is somewhere in between. And I think it's a very dangerous and limiting way to look at journalism, because it prevents reporters from doing what they would normally do, is just, you know, kind of follow the information where it naturally goes and just come to a conclusion. If you feel like you have to stay within certain intellectual bounds, you know, then you're going to train your audiences not to think critically about everything. And I think that's where we are.
So Chomsky and Herman's book was, of course, really significant for you and powerful. But of course, it came before three big things happened. You mentioned 24-hour cable and this relentless news cycle. It came before the explosion of conservative talk radio and the kind of Fox News style programming. It came before the internet. So there was a lot that happened, of course, after that. And I'm guessing you're thinking about your writing as sort of maybe updating the concept for what we're seeing today.
Yeah, that was the original idea, is that I thought, what would manufacturing consent look like if it was done in the internet age? Yeah. And you're exactly right. All those changes that you mentioned had a profound impact on the business. When Chomsky and Herman wrote that book, there were three networks and really a couple of big newspaper chains, and they were all gunning for the widest possible audience. If you remember that, you know, anchors like Walter Cronkite, you know, they would say, you know, hello everybody, basically, right? They weren't tailoring their broadcast to one particular demographic or another. When the cable cycle came around, that started in motion a couple of things. Number one, it radically changed the kind of content that we had, because no longer were we trying to just do a 2-minute report about something that was going to be structured and argued. They were instead looking for something that had a visual or a breaking element to it, and they found that they had all these oceans of time that they had to take up. Yeah. And the easiest way to do that was to just have people on set talking about something, and talking pretty quickly devolved into arguing, which was a much cheaper way of putting action on screen than, I don't know, filming someone trying to rescue the people from the sunken submarine in the Arctic or something like that. Arguing became, I think, central to American media life in large part because of that. And there was that, and then there was the fact that the splintering of the media landscape made it commercially feasible for media companies to no longer go after everybody. They, you know, Fox News was the innovator here, where they just decided, we're going to forsake half the audience, but we're going to dominate this conservative older white audience. And that was a remarkably successful commercial formula. And it started a lot of companies down the road of doing that exact same thing, of sort of identifying one part of the demographic, biosphere, and trying to make that their own little corner of the zoo.
So as you started plugging in these new models, new platforms into the ideas in the book Manufacturing Consent, and all that sort, all those sort of unconscious signals, did you see that it worked? Did you see that it was relevant, even though they didn't have the right platform because that had changed? Did it still work as a theory?
Yeah, I think Manufacturing Consent has held up in a lot of ways, and it's funny, when I went to talk to Noam Chomsky about this, because I actually didn't want to do this project without, you know, I guess his blessing is the wrong word, but without telling him anyway.
Yeah,
and we talked about what had changed over the years, and you know, he was pretty open about the fact that a lot of things were different. You know, his original book talked about, you know, using anti-communism as an organizing religion of the media. Well, that's, you know, no longer really the case, because there's no more, you know, communism. But a lot of things were still the same. Like, you saw exactly the same kind of instinct to, you know, limit the debate when, for instance, the Iraq War buildup happened, right? There were only two opinions that were allowed back then. Either we had to go in immediately to stop Iraq from building a nuclear weapon, or we had to wait until international inspectors completed their jobs and we had, you know, a UN backing to do it. There was no "let's not do it." that wasn't part of the national media debate. So I think, you know, the model still works. It's just different, you know, and it's been changed significantly by a lot of the financial pressures in the business.
It's interesting to read about your conversation that you had with Chomsky. You ask him in this interview that you published as part of the book, that you said, "When did this idea first come to you?" And I was really surprised. He was like 10 years old when all of this started to come to him.
Yeah, it was that was a surprise to me, because I'd never heard him say that. But he did say that he'd been thinking about this since he was very young, and that these were ideas that he'd been developing probably early, you know, in the early 70s, they started to come to the forefront of his mind. He co-wrote a book with Herman before Manufacturing Consent that was, you know, about the political economy of the United States. But This strictly media-based approach, they didn't really start that until I guess the late 70s, early 80s. So, but you know, it's central to the way he looks at politics, and I thought it was interesting, because he's not a journalist in any way, but he has a really interesting take on the business.
What did you see as the difference between you taking on this subject not as an academic or a theorist or a critic, but as a working reporter? Because that's an interesting difference.
Yeah, and I found that made a huge difference, because when I started writing about this, I, as somebody who's been doing this now for almost 30 years, I ended up, all these things sort of poured out, these frustrations about little tiny things that I think a non-journalist really wouldn't care about, but, you know, some, like, these little deceptions in political reporting that I guess had been driving me up a wall for decades, because they just sort of flooded out into the page when I started writing about them. But, you know, there are things that happen when, for instance, you cover a presidential campaign and you start to notice certain words popping up over and over again. And I don't think they'd be significant to an academic, but a reporter will notice a lot of these little things that are sort of designed to influence audiences in a certain way. And what I ended up doing is just sort of pouring it all out like a taxonomy, basically. And that ended up being, you know, cathartic for me. Let's put it that way.
I think it's interesting, the story that you tell when you first started covering a presidential election, and how you were kind of literally turning your camera or your view onto the media itself. Like, you weren't covering you were covering the candidates, of course, but you were also interested in look at the way the media is covering all of this. And the media didn't like it. they didn't like it at all.
No, and I had only just come back to the United States. I lived most of my adult life overseas. Yeah. I'd been in Russia for like 11 years, or the former Soviet Union anyway. So I had only just come back, and I didn't really know a whole lot about how the business worked here. And when I went out on the campaign trail, I guess I was covering Kerry at the time. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed that the way the media covered campaigns was an essential part of the story that everyone would want to look at, because you know it's a huge part of the equation, yeah. Right? You know, like, yeah. how journalists respond to things. Of course, you'd want to look at that. I mean, I remember there was a moment in the campaign when Matt Drudge published something to the effect that Kerry had a mistress stashed in Africa. And everybody on the plane just sort of bolted to write stories about this. And I was fascinated by the idea that, well, why aren't we confirming this first? Why do we have to rush this on the air? And that's crazy. And so I asked some people what their thinking was about that. And next thing I knew, I was banished to the back of the plane. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, sitting with techies, and I got, you know, cameras next to me. And it was a really bizarre experience.
Matt Taibbi. His book is called Hate Incorporated. He's publishing the book through the e-newsletter platform Substack. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why it is you might hate the media. Our guest is Rolling Stone journalist Matt Taibbi, who's written a book that he describes as an insider's guide to the pressures at work in media. A lot of the times, it works based on hate. In fact, the book is called Hate Incorporated: How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate One Another. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. I want you to talk about what seems like one of the important themes of the book, and that is that, as you put it, news is a consumer experience. And it kind of gets at what you write about, this idea of objectivity, that we think about objectivity as this ethical position. But in fact, you say it has a commercial motive as much as anything.
Yeah, it's funny. There are all these debates about objectivity and how you have to use certain language to connote to the reader that you have impartiality, and but in fact, you know, if you pick up any major market newspaper or a major daily in America and you read that sort of characteristically flat third person prose that everybody uses with the pyramid lead and, you know, the quote in the third paragraph and that everybody's familiar with, that's not something that was developed for an ethical reason. I think a lot of people think it was. Actually, when I look back at it, what I found was that sort of distanced, neutral language was something that was developed by a radio broadcaster in the 30s because one of the sponsors insisted upon it because they found that it alienated some of the audience if you had too much personality or political slant in the coverage. So that language that everybody's familiar with, that they think of as objectivity, this sort of distanced take, was actually originally just a commercial strategy. And if you've lived overseas, you'll notice that other countries have completely different approaches to reporting. Like, you'll have first-person reporting on the front page of a newspaper. And, you know, that happens in Russia and other countries. But it's always been about making money in our business. It's, you know, there is an ethical element to it, but we're always selling you an experience when you pick up a media, you know, a newspaper or turn on a television program to watch the news. And the action is we're trying to hold your interest long enough so that you either buy the newspaper at a newsstand or consume the advertising. And so the job is to hold your attention. That's what it is. And I think people misunderstand that. They don't understand how powerful the commercial motive is and all of that. And they think that this is just a public service that we're engaged in. And it's really not. You know, in your case it is, but it's really not in our case.
Well, it's interesting you say that. So there's this idea of objectivity that works for a while, you know, seek out the broadest possible audience. But then the form starts to shift and change. You get things like Fox News, which seems to ditch the idea of objectivity in some ways. It becomes kind of theater. And I've heard you talk about how pro wrestling was kind of an interesting model for explaining just this kind of theater and how it works.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I didn't really pay a lot of attention to wrestling until I had to cover the Trump campaign, and it was I had been sent out to cover him early in 2015, and it was pretty clear immediately that he was doing something that was radically different from other politicians. And I started to talk to people, and I realized that with his wrestling background, that he was, you know, engaging in this sort of classic heel act. And the whole idea behind wrestling, and wrestling is actually sort of an amazing literary concept when you start to get into it, and it took me a long time to get into it. But what they're doing is they're creating an allegory where there's pure good and pure evil, and there's this very dramatic, you know, confrontational ethic to it, where, you know, the good guy wrestler who's called the babyface is, you know, has to uphold his honor and decency and reputation, and the bad guy wrestler, the heel, is always trying to do something dirty to undermine him, and the crowd is supposed to cheer for the babyface and hate the heel, and so. But it's great theater, right? So the worse the heel is, the more disgusting and depraved he is, the better the show works, and the more ratings you get, and the more money you'll make. But it also works with news, you know. And I think what we found with the Trump phenomenon is that, you know, Trump injected that entire dynamic into news coverage, and it has taken off. He's making everybody a ton of money because he's the perfect heel, and we cover it just like wrestling too.
And we can't resist. I don't know how you resist, and it seems like this is the thing that's playing. I mean, all of his taunts, we're kind of suckers. It seems like.
Oh, there's no way to resist it. If you've been raised in, you know, especially in the commercial system of media, you have like this lizard brain thing that goes on in your head where you just have a sense of what's a story and what isn't, right? And you know that when Donald Trump says something like, you know, Jeb Bush needs his mommy or something like that, that's a story. You know, it just instantaneously, you know, that's a headline, right? And you can't not put it on the air. And he took advantage of that. He knew exactly what presses reporters' buttons, and that's why he got, you know, oceans of coverage, especially early in the campaign. You know, there was that period where even his empty microphone was getting coverage. I don't know. I don't know how you turn it off. And he was expert also at making the dynamic of the campaign about who was winning these little battles that he was creating between himself and, you know, his opponents. So, you know, he'll start off by doing something like saying Hillary Clinton got schlonged in a debate. And while everybody's freaking out about it, he draws, you know, Hillary Clinton into that discussion, and somehow he ends up making, you know, gaining an advantage from it. So I thought that was, all that is fascinating. But what's also fascinating is that it worked for the media on a financial level.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I started to watch that during the campaign, and that was when the idea for this book started to germinate in my head.
Well, you saw him coming. You saw someone like Donald Trump coming. You say that after what you witnessed in the election between Barack Obama and I think it was Mitt Romney, this was 2012, you said you knew that any candidate who was going to run against all of this stuff that you were noticing, all this kind of craziness, could do pretty well. And you had this, I think you describe it as a kind of flash of insight about someone like a Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think, you know, even even 10 years before, I had written some things to the effect of that I was noticing on the campaign trail that people in the crowds increasingly disliked the reporters. They were resentful of the coverage. They hated being caricatured. You know, when I first went out there, people loved to talk to reporters. Even conservatives liked to talk to Rolling Stone. You know, I would come up to people and they would start singing Dr. Hook at me as soon as I tried to interview them. But by 2008, people were mad. They didn't like the campaign process. There was something about it that they thought was incredibly phony and contrived and caricatured. And I had this idea that a person who ran against it would be successful. I mean, I didn't know it would be Donald Trump or that he would do it to that degree. But, you know, that was something I wrote about a long time ago, that yeah. Anybody who turned the cameras around on us was going to have some success.
So what did
and
you?
That's exactly what happened.
It is absolutely.
Yeah.
What did you make about all of the hand-wringing that was going on in the press after Donald Trump won? Because what you say is, you know, everyone was talking about, oh, we blew it, or now we need to reform the way we do things. But you say there wasn't really, in fact, a real assessment of what had happened. And in fact, you say the press kind of doubled down on being obnoxious. You know, you talk about all the back padding by news organizations and using the word lie to refer to Donald Trump's, you know, lies. And it just seems like that your sense of what you were seeing after all of that was that they're still not really getting it.
Yeah, I don't think they did, because the reform, when reporters first started talking about this, and there was a lot of shop talk that went on the plains and in, you know, on the trail, and we people argued about this. We said, what do we have to do differently? And the solution that most people came to was the one that Jim Rutenberg ended up writing about in the New York Times, which was we had to sort of change our attitude towards Donald Trump and be more overtly negative, and we had to redefine objectivity and truth. He talked about truth now being, you know, defined as being true to the judgment of history, which, you know, really meant sort of ditching the traditional idea of objectivity and distance. But that I don't think that was the mistake that we made. I don't think that was why we were unpopular to begin with. We were unpopular with people long before Donald Trump even ran for president. And I think that had a lot to do with the fact that we weren't paying attention to what was going on with ordinary people's lives out there.
Yeah.
I think if we wanted to correct the negative perceptions that most people had about the media, we had to stop sort of paying attention to the dumb soap opera aspects of campaigning and go out and talk to people about, you know, opiate addiction and you know, how hard it is to make, you know, their bills every month. And, you know, that was the stuff that people wanted to talk about. But that's not what you see when you turn on campaign coverage. And I think what ended up happening is we doubled down on it. Instead of listening to people more, which is what I think we should have done, we actually just went more negative on Donald Trump, which is just not a solution to me. I mean, I understand it, but it's not fundamentally changing the way we do business.
What were you seeing in newsrooms in terms of the culture? Because this is one of the things you talk about. I'm not sure elitism is exactly the way you talk about it, but it was concerning that you didn't have kind of blue-collar, working-class perspectives in newsrooms. That was something that you – like Mike Roykoy, you talk about Roykoy as one of those old-school journalists that offered a perspective of working class America that you weren't seeing in newsrooms on the coasts. You know, people who had gone to these liberal arts colleges that were kind of lacking something.
Yeah, you know, and that was something that I noticed, because when I was a kid, reporters were again, it was no panacea back then, because almost all the people in the press were white men. So that was obviously had a huge negative associated with it all by itself. But reporters were not, by and large, upper class people back then. You know, a lot of journalists didn't even go to college. There were a lot of people who started as sort of copy boys, or, you know, worked as printers. You know, the original history of journalists usually was that in a small town, it was the person who knew how to operate the local printing press, right? So it wasn't like a thing that you went to go to a fancy school to learn about. That culturally started to change in the 70s. I think, you know, all the president's men had a lot to do with that, and suddenly it became like a sexy profession for upper class, well educated people, and you know, I'm part of that phenomenon myself. I think the ordinary person who went into journalism back in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s was, you know, he or she might have been the son of a plumber or somebody, something like that. Right. Now, in this day and age, almost everybody you see on the campaign trail is the graduate of an Ivy League school, and that carries, it's a very different thing. I remember hanging out with reporters, you know, when I was a little kid in my dad's offices, and just reporters hated every politician. They weren't particular about what parties they belonged to. But like, if you put a poster of a politician up on the wall, they would deface it instantly and throw darts at it. It didn't matter who they were. They just hated the man, hated politicians, wanted to stick it to somebody. That kind of attitude is a little bit gone. There's this new thing that's more about kind of being close to power and trying to be a chronicler of it. That's and being part of the process. That is a completely new phenomenon in journalism, and I think people have picked up on that. And that's one of the things that Trump exploited during the 2016 race, is that he overtly identified us as part of the elite, mm-hmm. and he wasn't completely wrong, which was the problem.
It's like the White House Correspondents' Dinner. It seems like the manifestation of this. What you're talking about.
Exactly. Like there are people who I know from, you know, when I was a kid who wouldn't stop vomiting if they had to watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah.
And you know, I understand that not everybody goes because they feel like they really want to. It's a lot of people go out of a sense of obligation. But there's this sort of like mutual admiration society thing that goes on in that atmosphere between politicians and reporters that is totally unnatural, and it's just not a good look for us. You know, we should sort of be adversaries always. And, you know, even if we have sympathy for people in power and what they're doing. And again, I think the public has picked up on that. They see us as courtiers and not as people who challenge authority.
Matt, I wanted to go through some of what you call these 10 rules of hate. You say that pretty much now any major story in any major newspaper or on any network television news broadcast checks certain boxes. These are the 10 rules of hate. And I wanted to go through some of these. Whereas in the past, as you say, it used to be that the media sold unity and conformity, and we've talked about how now there's this transition. Now it sells division, basically. And so let's go through a couple of these. Let's start with number one. There are only two ideas.
Right.
Talk about that.
Yeah. We live in a country that's 300 million people. There should be, you know, countless different points of view on everything. But really, when you talk about the people who are on TV and are coming up there as political commentators and are offering their point of view on things, there's only two ideas represented. You're either pro-Democrat or pro-Republican. You don't see somebody who sort of has a fundamental disagreement with both parties very often. You don't see somebody who's just a pacifist or a cynic or, you know, a pox on both houses kind of an attitude. Almost everybody is there to sort of represent one half of that crossfire WWE dynamic, because what we're doing is we're training audiences to be rooters instead of thinkers. So when you turn on the TV, you're doing so as a Democrat or as a Republican, and when you turn it on, you have to have somebody to either identify with or hate right away, or else the product doesn't work. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the most important things, is that we have this dichotomy in all information. You're looking at one thing or the other always.
When you were involved in some of these, because you've sort of copped to the fact that you've, you know, for example, you've been on Bill Maher's show Real Time from time to time, so you've sort of been in that place where there were, you know, only two ideas, or these ideas in permanent conflict, which is number two of your list. The two ideas are in permanent conflict. What's it like being part of that? Because I know you felt uneasy. But what's it like? Are they actually telling you to do this, or do you just unconsciously play a role?
No, I think it's much more unconscious, although it's probably increasingly conscious for most people. But, yeah. You know, now there's really no way to market yourself unless you belong to one of those categories. I remember coming home from Russia in 2001, 2002 and going into a bookstore and going to the political section of the bookstore, and there were two shelves. There's books for conservatives and books for liberals, right? And they even look different from a distance. If you remember Al Franken's first book, he actually did the cover design in a way that was designed to look like a Republican book from 10 feet away. And it's so striking, even the sort of aesthetics of it, that and I always thought it was strange. Like, why would you, as a publisher, want to signal to people, to half an audience from 10 feet away, that this is not a book for you? But that's what we do. We have books for one side and books for the other, and there's no shelf for both or neither, you know. And that's a very strange thing. So it's the financial aspect of it. You just can't market yourself unless you fit in one of those slots.
Is it greed that's motivating people?
No, I think it has a lot to do just with the basic financial reality of making money in the business. Like, if you're a publisher and you're thinking about how am I going to sell this book, you know, by this author, well, you know, I think in terms of what the audience is right now, the audience right now is split. You have conservative readers and liberal readers, and you have to think about how you're going to sell the book to one of those two groups. So, you know, if Bernard Goldberg comes in and he wants to write a book about how the media is biased towards liberals, well, you know right away how you can sell that book. You know exactly what font you're going to put it in. But, you know, if somebody comes in and they have a completely different point of view, agents are going to say it. Publishers are going to say it. They're going to say, I don't know how I'm going to sell that book. You know, I don't know who's going to read it. So you end up kind of drifting in one side or the other. And that's something I've struggled with in my career for sure. But I think a lot of people do.
One of the 10 rules of hate is no switching teams. And this gets us to this idea of balance, the way the word balance is used. You write about the critique about balance that was coming from liberal-leaning audiences after the Trump administration, for example, that balance was, you know, you heard a lot of, well, let's not engage in this both sidism or that's a false equivalency. I think that's really interesting. Tell us about the experience of Liz Spade. Because it seems like her experience that you write about in the book is kind of instructive here.
Yeah, you know, she was responding to that editorial I was talking about before by Jim Rutenberg, and to complaints that readers had about things like the use of the word lie and the insufficiently aggressive tone towards Donald Trump. And you know, her take was very old school New York Times, which was, we just can't take sides in this. We end up losing our audience if we signal to them that we're leaning one way or the other in terms of our description of somebody. So even though, you know, the audiences may want a more aggressive treatment of this or that politician, a smart journalist will know that if they give in too much to the, you know, the crowd's desire for sort of more colorful language, and I know I sound like a hypocrite because I use the most vicious language there is, but that ultimately you're going to end up losing those readers, and that you know, a paper like the New York Times has to kind of stay out of it. And she was essentially ridden out of the Times for taking that stand, even though it was, you know, 2 years ago even was completely a mainstream idea in the business. So that just spoke to how quickly things have changed in the media landscape in the last couple of years, especially because of Trump.
Well, to that end, you just see then this idea accelerating. You don't see – do you not see any effort among some – I mean, your book is one, but this kind of effort at trying to find some other kind of equilibrium, trying to, you know, raise questions against what seems to be going on right now?
You know, I don't, and I think it's really dangerous. I was talking to a – a radio sportscaster today who, when we were sort of talking about how the news was increasingly borrowing from the way sports is covered, right? So if you're a sportscaster in a city like Boston or New York or Chicago, and your team is playing, you know, some other city's team, then all you're going to hear about all week is how much you hate that other city and how those people are horrible and, you know, their teams cheat and, you know, everything's negative and it's all out war constantly. And, you know, that's kind of the way political writing has devolved right now. Right now, if you turn on the news, there's, you know, you're going to see news that caters to either Democratic audiences or Republican audiences. There's nothing in between. There's no effort at conciliation or trying to understand or trying to go into a different direction or trying to humanize, you know, the other side. And there's just none of that. It's just, you know, these people are good. These people are bad. Here's why. And that instinct has accelerated so significantly in the last couple of years. Then I worry because it's gotten to the point where it would be controversial to say something like, you know, most Republicans are human, right? Mm-hmm. Or care about their kids too, or something like that. You know, I think that's dangerous. You know, it's because what ends up happening is that you're mixing up the commercial dynamic of trying to retain the Democratic or Republican audience with real political issues. And so is the amount of division out there real, or is it driven by the fact that we have to keep out cranking all this content that feeds what audiences want to hear? And I just think we're just taking a divided situation and making it even worse by doing things the way we do it.
It gets at something that I think Noam Chomsky was talking to you about in your conversation when you went down to Arizona to talk to him. This kind of, for first of all, I think Chomsky was frustrated that people thought his book was dismantling undermining mm-hmm. journalism. It's not what he was trying to do. He was trying to explain the way the system had come to work, and I think he was frustrated also about the way people were talking about Trump's kind of petty behaviors and not really focusing on the stuff that was happening, the important stuff, you know, breaking down regulation or foreign policy, those kinds of things. Say something about that if you would.
Yeah, no, I think he was very frustrated because he felt like, in a way, books like Manufacturing Consent and the kinds of things that I say have, you know, I hate to admit it, I think have contributed to a lot of the Trump phenomenon, because there's a lot of distrust and anger towards the media out there that has been exploited by a lot of these new political movements. Mm-hmm. And I think Chomsky was feeling a little conflicted about that, because his book Manufacturing Consent wasn't trying to say that the things that you read in the New York Times are fake news, that they're incorrect. As he put it to me, the Times is full of facts. It's just that an educated person has to understand the context in which these facts are presented, and try to understand there's a limitation there, and that there's a whole other world of information that you also have to find out in order to make sense of that. And but you know, this idea that the press lies is pervasive now, and now I don't know how we fix that situation when it's turned into to what it is now, which is, it's like a rooting society. You know, I don't know who to trust when I read the news these days. I increasingly distrust even the factual elements of things in newspapers, and I never had that feeling before. So that's frustrating.
Seems like, let me ask you this finally, because it gets at that sense of kind of helplessness, I think. I mean, one of the last things you say in the book is that you can't fix what you can't see. So that's what you're getting at in the book. Like, let's talk about the way this system has come. Let's make it conscious if we can, I guess. And But do you sense there's any fixing it? I mean, if you have a certain unconscious ecosystem that's at play with these certain incentives set up like they are now, there doesn't seem like there's much of a reversing course at this point.
No, because, again, the financial incentives just don't work in the way of anything that would correct the problem. I think you find in public journalism, you know, for sure, and in local journalism, small newspapers, they tend to be more immune to a lot of these forces. But at the very largest level, the stuff that Chomsky was talking about, you know, that the networks are focusing on these, you know, Trump's tweets and doing massive specials on it and devoting hours and hours and hours on this, you know, WWE soap opera stuff that is making them literally billions of dollars a year, there's no incentive to step out of that format and try to figure out what's gone wrong. Even though I think a lot of reporters are conscious of the fact that they've become less popular with people over the years, but in the rare instances when they try to investigate why that is, they always come to the conclusion that people are just ignorant and don't know what they're talking about, rather than understand that it's connected to a few real things that we probably do need to correct, and that's unfortunate. You're right. I don't really see the fix on the horizon unless there's more public investment in media, and unless there's some kind of divorcing from the financial pressure of the news.
Matt Taibbi, his book is Hate Incorporated, How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate One Another. You can only get it with an online subscription right now, and there are links and more information about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.